Welcome to The Aperture, a podcast for curious minds and critical social thinkers, hosted by me, Steph Cutler. If you believe a better world is worth consideration, then you're in good company. Each episode, I chat with someone with views and or experiences of a social issue, and at the end, I hand over to a creative contributor who has the final say. Welcome to this, our first ever episode of the Aperture podcast. I'm really pleased to introduce our first guest as my friend, Phil Friend. And I can't believe we have Harry Baker, the poet, as our first ever creative contributor. In disability circles, Phil needs very little introduction. He's been a part of the disability equality space for over 30 years, largely within his own organisation, working nationally and internationally around the disability employment and disability customer experience agenda. On top of that, he's held the position of Chair of Disability Rights UK, and he's currently the Vice President of Level Playing Field, the Vice Chair of Activity Alliance, and the Chair of the Research Institute for Disabled Consumers. He was formerly a Commissioner on the Extra Costs Commission, and he's a Winston Churchill Fellow and a Fellow of the RSA. Phil was awarded an OBE and a Honorary Doctorate of Science from the University of Hertfordshire in recognition of his contribution to disability equality and social inclusion. He's also the co-author of a book called Why Are You Pretending to Be Normal? And he's the co-host of a podcast called The Way We Roll. I'll be speaking to Phil in a moment, but just to say you must wait on after hearing us speak to listen to Harry Baker. So I first heard Harry Baker perform his poetry in 2016 and I was blown away, thought he was incredible. Harry was the youngest ever World Poetry Slam champion in 2012. He has over 5 TEDx talks to his name and his viewings of those talks exceed over 5 million people. His fan base includes singer-songwriter Ed Sheeran and the author Jacqueline Wilson and me, Steph Cutler, and soon to be you. He's a full-time poet, has published poetry, done the Edinburgh Fringe and can be seen on the poetry circuit regularly. So be sure to hold out to hear from Harry at the end of this podcast. Both links to the work of Phil and Harry can be found in the show notes which accompany this episode, so check those out. So big thanks to Phil and Harry for joining us on our first pod. I began by asking Phil how, from his perspective, disability inclusion had changed over the decades.
Well, I think the first thing I would say is that there was no such concept of disability inclusion.
Yeah.
It just didn't exist. I mean, those two words were not used together. If you were lucky, you might have heard of independent living, but you certainly wouldn't have heard of inclusion and those kinds of, that language was just absent. We had no rights as such before 1995 and the Disability Discrimination Act. There was no rights. The nearest you got to that was the Chronically Sick, and I love these terms, the Chronically Sick and Disabled Persons Act. So disability was primarily seen as something that meant you were dependent, that you relied on local authorities or government support. The idea that you might run a business or be independent in a general sense was pretty absent. I mean, and we had support from government to do things like retraining. I mean, obviously you and I are very aware that many disabled people are created, they're not born disabled. So lots of people are minding their own businesses, getting on with their lives, and then suddenly something happens, they become disabled. And back then, they went along and got retrained for something, but it has to be said, it was all a bit Spartan and not very good.
Sort of the basket weaving kind of era.
That kind, and expectations, this was the thing, there was this lovely expression coined by, sadly, a woman who's now dead, but at one of the Business Disability Forum events, she said the slow bigotry of low expectation. This lovely idea that, you know, you're disabled, so we won't expect much of you. It's great that you can get out of bed in the morning. That's all you know, that kind of idea. The idea that you could be a successful entrepreneur or successful manager of something. And just to add to that, I don't think we had any concept really of equality, in the sense that I think the disability movement back in the 80s was probably as sexist as the non-disability movement. So women found it even tougher. I think many, many women of that time, Baroness Campbell, Jenny Morris, these names, they were fighting on two fronts. They weren't just fighting for the rights of disabled people, they were also fighting for the rights of women. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you had lesbians and so on who were also trying to get. So it got, you often, it wasn't a joke, it wasn't funny to be saying to somebody, which bit of you is being discriminated, you know, discriminated against today, you know. So very different landscape, completely different to how it is now.
I acquired my impairment, and upon diagnosis, I had rights, you know, and I'm acutely aware of the people who came before me who enabled that to happen, because a win like that kind of legislation just isn't won easily, and it enables me to live my life and work in the way I do today, which isn't always easy, but it's certainly a whole lot easier.
I think there were 13 attempts since the Second World War. So in 1945, there were 13 attempts to get disability rights legislation through the House of Commons. And it was finally successful in 1995 and almost came about by accident. It's not a political point. Both parties, the major parties, Labour and Conservative, voted against disability rights. It was hard fought. There were many before me, I mean, were campaigning. Mike Oliver, who died very recently, was one of the people. And Vic Finkelstein, these are names that people probably have never heard of. But when you go to think about the history of civil rights for disabled people, those names will be there, as would Jane Campbell's, obviously, who's still very much around and so on. But yeah, it was tough. And before it, yeah, you were lucky if you got, you know, much help, and the help was dished up in a format that wasn't of your choosing. Yeah, if you didn't fit, then you didn't get it, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I drove an invalid tricycle, which was given to me by the state, but I was only allowed to, I know it's called an invalid tricycle. I used to make jokes about it, you know, because the word invalid generally means invalid, you know, don't exist.
Yeah.
So used to trundle around in this three-wheeler, which was given to you so you could go to work, because you couldn't use public transport and things like that. It's just, the situation has changed hugely, but that doesn't mean that it's done. That it's sorted, that everything's okay, because we know it isn't. It may have changed in all sorts of ways, and many of the things that you now take for granted, as you said a few minutes ago, are in place. There are many other challenges that you face that we didn't worry about. For example, we're using social media. That didn't exist 20 years ago, but it's disabling people now.
So you're now, Phil, for, well, I think in your own words, you love to talk.
Really? I don't know where that came from.
I think you've said that previously. In fact, I've read that about you saying that you love to talk, but gladly people love to listen, which I don't think you can say of everybody who loves to talk. So that's a good start. I'm interested, how important for you is it to have a space to speak?
Do you know, that's a really interesting question. I wouldn't be anywhere, would I, if that were the case. I mean, I suppose there's two ways of looking at it. One way is to have the opportunity to say what you think and for people to hear it and either dismiss it because it's not relevant to them, or to pick up on it and decide to do something about it. That's one area of being heard. The other is to not be listened to at all, even though you have a voice. So I don't know how that feels, but I'm thinking specifically as I'm saying that about people, say, with learning disabilities, who have all sorts of issues that they want people to listen to and hear, but because of their conditions, they find it very difficult to express themselves. So either rely on others to do it for them. And we all know what that's about, because I don't like it. And I know you don't. I know you well enough to know that woe betide anyone talks on your behalf. Do you know what I mean? Because so I think I've been very fortunate that I have an ability to talk to people and to make it interesting, I guess. That sounds a bit pompous, but that seems to be the case.
If you think wider than you, what these days would you like disabled people to be saying, and how would you like them to say it?
I think at the moment, one of the big concerns I think I have and others have is the fear of saying anything for being shot down for saying it. Mm-hmm. So the recent massive social media stuff around people speaking their minds and then being trolled or all of that stuff, I think that's a real worry. And I think it does impinge on free speech, and it does mean that people are frightened of saying things. And if you already feel that your safety or your ability to survive is threatened, then would you say some of the things you want to say? So I think it is really worrying at the moment that we live in a world where communication is all around us, but actually it's telling people not to say anything.
Yeah, I think so. And I think also there's something about other people. So non-disabled people have quite often had concerns around saying the wrong thing about us or in front of us. And that's amplified by this. It almost takes it further, doesn't it? That idea about now we don't feel we can say what we want to for fear of the issues you've just mentioned. So yeah. I think non-disabled people have felt that for some time, coming from a good place, but largely being quite unhelpful. But now we're feeling it about ourselves almost. And yep. It's detrimental.
I think one of the things that's changed in my lifetime is that the 95 Act brought together disabled people from all different walks of life, different impairment groups, all of that sort of thing. And they were united around one thing, civil rights. Mm-hmm. Now, the tactics that we're going to be engaged with and all of that were often argued about, but the fact we wanted civil rights, that was not in dispute. What we ended up with was imperfect, and lots of people were very angry about that too. But we were united. And that experience came from a time when many of us were brought up in institutions. Many of us spent long periods together with each other. We don't have that kind of, I don't know what you'd call it, that kind of understanding of these same experiences. So the voice is weakened by that. We don't sort of speak in a united way in some ways, even though the communication tools available to us now are so much better than they used to be.
There doesn't seem a camaraderie with disabled people.
In some ways.
And we talk about disability in the wider sphere of diversity very often, but obviously within disability, there's a lot of diversity too. So we're not one group of people who all think and behave the same. And whilst that's the beauty of us, it perhaps doesn't help with the galvanizing of thought in terms of a movement. I wonder sometimes whether we're too disjointed to create social change collectively.
Yeah, I think that's true. But how do you join it all up so that it comes across as one? It's very difficult. And of course, disabled people's experiences are very different now because, as you said earlier, there are basic rights according to people now. So some of the obvious things are no longer so obvious. So the blind people talk about their issues and the deaf people talk about their issues. And to be honest, that's one thing that hasn't changed in my lifetime, really.
Okay.
The fact that we still have voluntary bodies working with specific impairment groups, and they are fighting each other in some ways for resources and to be heard and so on and so forth. So with the coming together to fight for the 95 Act, some of that stuff got suspended. I'm not a pessimist. When you look at non-disabled people, non-disabled young people, they can't agree about anything either. So it's not as if it's just us.
I don't know what the answer is, if indeed there needs to be one, that says this is who we are and this is what we want or need. It feels sometimes as though, and I slightly hesitate to use the word community because I don't really know who the disability community is. It gets used a lot, that word, and I'm not sure it's terribly accurate always, but I'll go with it. The disability community, if we can't agree, is that unhelpful in terms of creating social change? Or are we going to create social change in pockets that actually, if we all do our bit in our way, in our space, perhaps we don't need to be one. Perhaps that will create collective change independently.
One of the most recent challenges has been the non-visible impairment groups, people mm-hmm. that have conditions which are not visible, which fluctuate, which may be mm-hmm. seen more as health issues, long-term health issues, and they don't necessarily identify as disabled people themselves. Mm-hmm. There is a really complex conversation going on about all of that. And one of the things that united us, and I think unites many of us still, is what we used to call and still call the social model of disability, which by and large focuses on, are there barriers? If so, what are we going to do to get rid of them or overcome them? Now, if you have a long-term health condition which changes from time to time, and but you're not, your barrier is your health condition, i.e. your inability to, say, work, isn't because the employer won't give you a job, it's because your energy levels are so variable that you can't hold down a job, in quotes. The social model doesn't work quite so well there. So the unifying features of dismantling barriers for some people is not relevant. Although, mm-hmm. as an old social modeler, I think it's attitudinal, maybe. The barriers are attitudinal. But I do think that we're dealing now with some really complex issues, which perhaps back in 20 years ago, we didn't really understand or even talk about. We were so clearly talking about equality and fairness. And I do think there's something in that word fairness. Is what's happening to you fair? If someone else can do it and you can't, that's not fair. So what are we going to do about it? There's some of that. I always think children get a very good sense of what's right and wrong by, he had a biscuit and I can't have a biscuit, that's not fair. Do you remember that when you were a kid? The sense Absolutely. Of injustice, you know? Yeah. And I think some of that, perhaps we should go back to thinking about it a bit like that, you know, that sense of injustice. Whatever the reason is, isn't relevant. Mm-hmm. It's not right. It shouldn't be going on. I think the other thing, there's a lot more around, and you know, it's been going on for a long time, is the sort of individualism stuff. It's about me and what I need and what I want and those kinds of things, rather than what we want, what we need. So there's some of that going on. And I think because now we have the ability to have 5,000 groups online, mm-hmm. We can join one of them and there may only be 10 of us. Well, that's not likely to get us very far if what we're trying to do is change the world. Although, to be fair, most movements always start with one individual who decides something's not right and they gather unto them, you know, a few other people. Mm-hmm. And before you know it, you've got the women's rights movement. You know, it's so yeah. I shouldn't knock the small groups. I just think somehow they're all ploughing their own furrows, and what they're not doing is looking across the field to see how many other furrows there are that are just the same as theirs. Let me nail my colours firmly to the mast. I do not believe that societies become fairer without legislation. Mm-hmm. I think the legislation we've got is too weak. I don't think it's enforced. And I don't think it makes people sit up and take much notice. And by people, I mean the discriminators. Now, I am talking primarily, you mentioned in your introduction, I am primarily interested in the employment space. And I can tell you without fear of contradiction that there is plenty of discrimination going on in employment. And the reason it's going on is because people are not policing it. It's not being made public and people aren't being brought to book for it. Not in the way that they should be. So for me, the first thing I would do is start looking at how do we enforce what we've got? How do we improve what we've got? How do we make it more meaningful for disabled people themselves and for employers? Make it clearer to everybody, this isn't right and you will stop doing it. I think Black Lives Matter is an amazing catalyst. You do not kneel on my neck. That is not going to happen anymore. You know, that kind of very clear demarcation between behavior and impact. You're not going to do it. And if you do, we're going to fire you. We've had 25 years of the disability rights in this country. And it's time we revisited it and say, is it still fit for purpose? I think the Equal Opportunities Commission or the Equality and Human Rights Commission, to be fair, are hugely under-resourced, good people in it, very little power and under threat. This current government have made it clear they're not very happy with the Equality and Human Rights Commission. For me, they should be policing this. They should have all the resources they need to ensure that people are treated fairly, because that's what they're set up for. Disability Rights Commission that was, I think, did a brilliant job in the short time it was around to not only bring cases and highlight the injustices, but they also brought an enormous amount of education and information. And, you know, it wasn't just about the big stick. There were lots of helpful things going on to try and encourage employers in particular to get it right. And I don't believe employers want to get it wrong deliberately. There are some who do, but mostly it's ignorance. So, legislation. Yeah. Start there and let's make what we've got work better.
So is it time for some sort of new movement as such? And if you were to recommend that, what would you suggest would be included and what would you suggest should be avoided?
What governments always do when they've got a problem is to have a royal commission, don't they? So they can kick the can down the road for another 5 years. I would want to do an audit of what's gone on that's worked. Over the last 15, 20 years, what have we done that really worked? What made a real difference? I'd like to review that, because if we can identify key drivers that got change, I'd like to bottle them and try them again, but in a modern context. Second thing, I think, is that we need to engage much more with groups and individuals and drill down into what is it that's not working for them. I mean, you mentioned I'm getting older. You're absolutely right. I'm talking in the context of my lifetime. I am not 22. I don't know what that's like. I don't know what it's like now to be 22 with a severe kind of disability of whatever kind. So in the context of today, what does that 22-year-old say the issues are? And let's look at strengthening legislation for that. Bear in mind, the 95 Act talked about work and service provision. It didn't talk about the internet. It didn't talk about social media. I know it's umbrellaed, and I know that there is this loose idea that the internet should be accessible. But is it? Well, we know it isn't. So I think it's looking at the context of now and saying, what are the issues that today's 20-somethings are facing, and what would we need to do to make it better for them? And I think the 95 Act was couched and written by people who were in their 30s and 40s then.
Yeah, I was about to say, what do they need to do for themselves, you know, with the support?
What, the 20-somethings?
Yeah, with support of their elders, you know?
Well, they've got to stop fighting amongst themselves. That's the first thing they've got to do. They've got to welcome other impairment groups. I love the idea that back in the day when we, you know, wheelchair users, white men in wheelchairs were the supreme beings, you know, blind women, well, they were somewhere. I don't know about the deaf group and learning disabled people, well, they were nowhere. There was this kind of hierarchical view and we all fought our own corners and stuff. Now, I think to be fair, the 95 Act did help some of that, but we talked about free speech. Are we able to say things about each other without being cast out and banished to the wilderness? Because what hasn't changed is people with mental health conditions and people with learning disabilities are still at the bottom of the heap. When we look at employment, they are the two groups that have the biggest single issues. I know blind people do too. But
yeah, we're not far behind. But yeah,
we're not far behind. So there's this kind of sense of where we need to somehow find a way of forming a common voice again, which brings that to the attention, and we support each other to get things changed. It was ever thus. I don't think it's changed in that sense. I don't know if I've answered your question, really. I wish I knew
the answer.
I can't
remember what the question was, don't worry. I was just listening with interest, so don't worry.
Brilliant. It's finding a way of hearing what people are saying and listening hard and then developing with them a plan, something that's going to work. You know, when you and I do our work with individual people, personal development plans, we sit down, we identify the problems, we come up with some thoughts about that, And then the individual goes away and tries to do something about it. So what's wrong with that as a model? You know, if I'm working with the RNIB, for example, what are the issues? How do we think we can change those issues? Let's look at other groups and see what they learned.
You mentioned the women's liberation movement back in the day. You know, there's been Me Too recently, Black Lives Matter recently, you know, gay pride exists. You know, we don't seem to have had anything in recent times for people to get behind. And I think there's also something about people choosing not to want to because they don't want to use the D word, which, you know, I'm not particularly judging for that. But there are many, many people who wouldn't even if there was something to get behind because they're still not really comfortable with living and working as a person with an impairment or a health condition and avoiding sharing and telling and using the D word to describe themselves. So therefore, I think that, you know, with other sort of protected characteristics, that doesn't exist in the same way as I see it.
No, you're right.
Not to the same extent, perhaps.
Yeah, one of the first things happens to you when you're told you've got when you were told your sight loss was related to X, was to say, is there anything can be done about that? And when the answer came back, no, that left you then thinking, what the hell am I going to do? Now, when you were born, somebody didn't say, oh, it's a girl. What are we going to do about that? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a pride about, you mentioned it, you know, gay pride. There's a pride. Women have pride about who they are. Black people too, you know. But disability is about, no cure. Nobody wants a disability. So we have to recognize that for many, many people in our club, they don't want to belong. They don't want to be part of it. They want to get fixed. There are, of course, the rest of us who are quite happy being as we are and take pride in who we are. And we love the sorts of things we've been able to do and the way we've been able to change the world around us and that kind of thing. We love that. That's what it's about. So we'll go on the march. The other lot, bless them, are all queuing up at the doctors to try and find a way out of this. So that's one of the big challenges. How do we fight for equality? So I suppose one of the things you say to the group who are looking for the cure, while you're looking, what's the problem you face that we might be able to fix now? What's going on around you? So, okay, you can't see. For you, that's horrific. You want to get it fixed. But what about the way you're being treated because of that? Shouldn't we, that isn't going to go away while you look for your cure. Let's try. So it's sort of trying to build a bridge between those people who genuinely don't want to be disabled and those of us who are, by focusing, and this is where I think the social model was so helpful, by focusing on the barriers that both groups face. It doesn't matter whether you want to get cured or whether you love being blind. The fact that the internet doesn't work for you is common to both. And what do we do about that? Together, you know?
Yeah, I think the work for me, it's something around the world isn't going to change in my lifetime to make things fair for me every time, every day. You know, it's just not. So what am I going to do in the meantime? Well, I need to get on with my life because I've only got one and we don't get that long on this planet. So there's something about making the most of it and not, you know, spending too much time seeking what's not really there.
Yes. You can waste an awful lot of your life.
Time and energy on something that might be unattainable. And I'm not suggesting people don't do some of that, but I also feel like, whilst you're doing that, the world keeps turning and the world right now is in one hell of a mess. Every which way you look, it feels right now. So it feels like it's not quite the right place to look. And I know you address lots of this in your book, Phil, you know, this idea about why are you pretending to be normal? And I know so many people who've read that book because I've recommended it to so many people who, for them, it's been a game changer because it's enabled them to see disability differently. And I think that has to be part of this story.
At the end of the day, what the book was about was trying to help people say there's another way of looking at yourself. There's another way of seeing the world in which you operate. You can see the world as, you know, a hostile place and everyone's out to get you, or you can see the world in a way where you can take control of things and make it different for you. So it's that kind of paradigm, really. But you're right. When you look around at the moment, you know, we are living through the COVID experience, which for many people is just so terrible. We have got global warming, climate change. We've got politicians that you wonder how the hell they ever got where they got. You know, wherever you look, like, you know, I'm watching polar bears on ice caps, you know, 100 years from now won't be around. Where the hell do you start? Well, I think the famous line was you start with the first step, don't you? So what is it that you're going to do next that's going to make a difference?
So we gave the youngest ever World Poetry Slam champion a sneak preview of the conversation I had with Phil, and this was his creative response.
We've come a long way since invalid tricycles. We didn't have rights as such until 1995. And even then, that was at the 13th time of asking, back when retraining equated to weaving baskets. There was no concept of disability inclusion. If you were lucky, you would have heard of independent living. There is the slow bigotry of low expectations. You might get out of bed, but you wouldn't run a business. Things have got easier, but that doesn't mean it's sorted. There's an assumption you are government supported. For many people, it's created, not something that you were born with. I am grateful for those who came before me. It only takes one person to start a movement. How do we take what we have and make improvements? People don't want to get it wrong. How can we educate them through this? How can we truly make things inclusive? In 95, we were united about wanting civil rights. We are all different, that's the beauty, but it's hard to galvanize. Being deaf is not the same as being blind, but surely justice is something that everyone can get behind. If we all do our bit, in our way, in our space, maybe independently we create these pockets of change. But if we plough our own furrows and don't look out across the field, there is a chance we miss out on a greater yield. Society has not become fairer without legislation. Is there room for the movement about celebration? Some would join that march without hesitation. Some would rather take themselves out of the equation. Some wouldn't use the D word. Some have non-visual impairments. Yet all would benefit from increased fairness. The reason isn't relevant, it's about right and wrong, and if something isn't right, that means that something must be done. It has been 25 years, and even then it wasn't perfect. Let's revisit it and see what's fit for purpose. The legislation should make the discriminators take notice. If something isn't fair, then that must be the focus. We need to find a way of hearing what people have to say. The challenges that we face then are not the same we face today. How do we give a voice to those denied that chance? Because woe betide anyone who tries to speak on your behalf. The world won't change in my lifetime to make things fair every time. But what am I going to do in the meantime? Get on with my life because you only get one. Identify what is in front of you, then ask what can be done. Why would you pretend to be normal? Seeing things differently has to be part of the story. You can change the way you see the world and shape your point of view. You could treat the world as hostile or make it work for you. Whether you're desperate for a cure or if it is something you love. If something isn't fair, that means that something must be done. The next step is what has an effect on things in the long run. Whichever way you look at it, it has to start with us.
Thanks for listening. Please subscribe so you don't miss a future episode of The Aperture on Spotify, YouTube, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Support us by leaving a review and recommending us. And The Aperture can be found on Facebook and Twitter. See you next time for more social change thinking.